want thousands of these things, or tens of thousands of these things, light little things, and they're going to eventually get to Alpha Centauri and somehow coalesce and connect with each other, you know. And then from that, they could reassemble themselves in orbit, or, well, they wouldn't make it in orbit. It would have to be a, they wouldn't be able to slow down. So it would be a flyby. And then they could reassemble and then transmit back to Earth. Dick, what do you think about that?
You and I could do a calculation of how strong a transmitter, how big a dish at Alpha Centauri is required to get a signal back to the Earth. And it is huge. Inverse square law tells me every time you double the distance, the signal gets 6 dB weaker. It takes a tremendous amount of doubling of distance to go from the 12 billion miles where Voyager is out to the Alpha Centauri. The free space loss to Voyager is 315 dB. That's a huge number. That's a 10 to the 31 power is how much weaker the signal is that you get compared to the one that they send. So, I don't think it's viable, Paul. These chips are going to reassemble themselves and make this superpower transmitter and super big dish to send back the signal. Or you both, K2IW, I doubt it.
Wish. Okay, that wasn't your and Milton's idea. That was mine. I was going to reassemble them when they got back. When they get made it to Proxima Centauri, not Alpha. Somebody said question.
Yeah, we're saying 16. Well, peak power. In a short impulse, you can get tremendous amount of energy. Megawatts, gigawatts, depends from what you're dealing with. So now, the question to you is, how much peak power, nanoseconds, impulse, you need to overcome space attenuation and pressure?
Yeah, once again, Wes, this on paper sounds good, but it's not. If you make the pulse brief enough in nanoseconds, a small amount of energy in joules can give you a lot of peak power. But because it's only nanoseconds long, the instantaneous bandwidth of that signal is many megacycles or even gigahertz. A nanosecond pulse requires a gigahertz of bandwidth. A gigahertz of bandwidth gives you a tremendous amount of bandwidth of noise. Now, to make the signal strong enough to overcome that noise is the problem. So when it comes to distance, peak pulse power is not the answer. The distance you get out of a radio signal is a function of the average power you transmit. You can decide to do it as CW, you can decide to do it as peaks. Broad bandwidth on the receiver. You pay the price. Average power of transmit gives you range. Does that make some sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2IW.
Yes, it does. But would you be kind enough to explain the nature of the noise? So I have 1 gigawatt impulse of 1 nanosecond. What is the relation of the noise?
The bandwidth of your receiver determines how much noise the receiver is going to be subjected to. That signal from Voyager is 12,000 miles, approximately a 10-watt signal. By the time it gets here, it's so weak that they have to use a 150 hertz bandwidth receiver to pick it up. So the data you're being transmitted back from Voyager is 150 bits per second, approximately. So you can only get a weak signal reception with narrow bandwidth. You make the bandwidth wider, you're accepting more noise. A 1 nanosecond pulse requires a 1 gigahertz bandwidth receiver. A 1 gigahertz bandwidth receiver compared to a 100 hertz bandwidth receiver, there's 80 some odd dB of difference in sensitivity because of the bandwidth. Whenever you increase the bandwidth of a receiver, the laws of physics mean you're accepting more noise. You double the bandwidth, you double the noise that's there. No matter what you're using as a preamplifier, no matter what you're using as a receiver or an antenna, double the bandwidth, you double the noise power. The signal has to be twice as strong to get above that noise. And to XJN, K2IW.
What is the lacking amplifier minimum signal sensitivity in the spectrum noise and to extreme.
I hear the words. I don't understand the question. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. We have a lacking amplifier, and those are able to de-signal all particular frequency at the particular time frame in within the noise that is many times stronger than that signal. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, a lock-in amplifier is a kind of a phase lock loop, and the weakness of the signal it can accept is a function of its noise equivalent bandwidth. If you're using a lock-in amplifier to listen to the Voyager signal, you'd be setting the phase lock loop with a 100 hertz or 150 hertz bandwidth. If you made the bandwidth any broader than that, it wouldn't find the signal, so to speak. So the lock-in amplifier is a way of tracking, it's a convenient way of tracking a signal that might be drifting or there might be a frequency error between your receiver and your transmitter. But the lock-in amplifier doesn't do any magic. It has some kind of a noise equivalent bandwidth. That bandwidth determines the sensitivity. We've got to go back to Paul. WS2N, K2LI, if you're good, Paul.
Okay, very good. Well, make a long story short, I guess Maddie Jamison isn't going to be making the news anytime soon by having a breakthrough with actually sending people. We can't even send little chips all the way to different star systems. I don't think she's going to do any good with people, but it's good, you know, to have the interest out there. Make people think. Might think of different kinds of engines, ion engines, maybe antimatter engines, if they could ever develop an antimatter system. But not for now, that's for sure. We're having trouble getting to Mars right now. Everybody wants to go to the moon, and that's the next topic here. The Israel, a company named SpaceL, launched spacecraft not too long ago called Bereshit, which means Genesis in Hebrew, and they launched it on a Falcon 9 rocket not too long ago, a couple of months ago in February, and their plan is to have Bereshit land on the moon. And this company started out years ago when they had a Google Prize of like $10 million to the goal was to land on the moon, take high-definition pictures, and then somehow take off or drive to a different location 500 meters away and then do the same thing, take high-definition pictures, and then you would get these millions of dollars from Google. Well, that prize was taken away after about 10 years or so. 2017, Google cut it off and said, nobody did it. Well, that's it. Well, this company was on the way, but a little late, but they continued on, and SpaceL decided to launch this thing anyway. So if it makes it to the moon, it's only going to last a couple of days. It's just going to run on batteries, and it'll transmit pictures back to Earth. And it does have a quantum reflector type of thing on board the spacecraft. NASA put that on, where you could send lasers from either here or from orbit around the moon to get exact measurements of where this thing is located. Now, it didn't make it yet. It spent a couple of months trying to get to the moon. It kept getting into a higher and higher orbit around the Earth until eventually it got out near the moon, and when the moon went by, the moon captured the spacecraft in its gravity well. And just the other day, Thursday, well, I think it was Thursday, but it got captured into the orbit, and it went into the orbit of the moon. So it's a big success. It's a private company. It's not a country that did this, and they paid a private company to get it there. They paid SpaceX to give it a ride on board. SpaceX was actually launching another vehicle on they were putting up a satellite like the 6,000-pound satellite from Indonesia into geosynchronous orbit. And what they did is they took this barosheet and put it on the very tippy top of the rocket, and this way, when the second stage lit and eventually pushed this thing into a geosynchronous orbit, the first spacecraft that was released was Barosheet from SpaceL, and then later on they put the Indonesian communication satellite into geosynchronous orbit, so that pushed this spacecraft on the way. That's a couple of pictures. I don't know if they're going to wind up on roy.ac2gs.com or not. It's like a total of four pictures. But there's a picture of the spacecraft on top of the Indonesian spacecraft getting assembled in front of fairing. And there's another picture of this spacecraft when it's like halfway to the moon. It took a selfie of itself looking back toward Earth, the Earth in the background, and you know, it's got a sign up there, you know, it's one of those deals. But this this thing should land April 11th, so that'll be on Thursday. If it lands, it'll start transmitting pictures back from the moon. Hopefully, I'll be able to do that next week or the week after when we're back for the next net, and put that on to Roy's site as well, of actual picture of the SpaceL's vehicle sitting on the lunar surface. So it's, you know, it's got a laser retro reflector on it, and it's got some other test equipment on board the spacecraft. But it's only going to last a couple of days. It's just an accomplishment by this company. If they do it, they actually plan on building more of these types of things in the future. You know, they're not going to give up. But it runs on hydrazine fuel for the main engine. To get into orbit, it slowed itself down by around 600 miles an hour, and slow enough. You know, I think it's down to around 4,000 miles per hour now. And that was enough to get it into orbit around the moon. So one of the pictures I sent is where this thing is actually going to land. It's going to land in the Mare Serenitatis, or Sea of Serenity. And if you look at the moon picture, you'll see the Sea of Serenity up in the top right hand corner. That's where when we're looking at the moon, that's where you would look. And we'll see how they do. Good luck to SpaceL.
What's the main purpose of that craft, Paul? Go to the moon, take some pictures, send them back home, establish a laser retro reflector. Is there any other further purpose than just saying it can be done and this is the lead to further missions downrange? Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, for SpaceL, it is a lead to further missions. They do have some kind of detectors for a magnetic field they plan on studying, but that's pretty much it. It started out as a competition. They wanted to be the first one to win the Google Prize, but since that's over, they're going to get the publicity prize, that's for sure. You know, first company, private company to actually do this. We have a couple of companies in the United States that have been trying to do this for years, and apparently these people won. There's one guy, Richardson, from Moon Express. He's got a facility down in Florida, and he's very close to being able to do the same thing. He plans on eventually launching on either SpaceX or another company. He hasn't decided yet, but there's a few other companies that are still doing this. There were like 20 different companies at one time around the globe that were competing for the Google Prize.
There's enough thrust on board to stop the 4,000 miles an hour of lunar orbit, bring that down to zero at the lunar surface. So I guess it's going to use a rocket landing. There's a lot of steps in between there that can go wrong. roughly how many pounds of hardware are going to be deposited onto the moon, if you happen to know, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of small. That's why I put the picture on the... It'll winds up on that website. See, the size of it, it's about the size of a washing machine, so a couple hundred pounds. That's it. No rover. Now, India plans on launching a spacecraft to the moon very shortly, within a month or so. And they do have a rover on that one, so they got to have an orbiter, a lander, and a rover on India's launch vehicle, and they launch their own stuff. They have two main rockets that they use, the Polar launch vehicle and the Geosynchronous launch vehicle. We're going to launch it on this smaller vehicle, and then they said, let's use the bigger one. So they're going to use the Geosynchronous launch vehicle to put this lander on the moon. So that's their goal, and that's a little bit bigger, of course, than the Bravo sheet. So, you know, everybody's jumping on the moon bandwagon. China's got a rover riding around on the dark side of the moon. We have an orbiter that's been in orbit around the moon for the last 11 years. For it's a reconnaissance vehicle, LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So that one's all NASA, and it's taking wonderful pictures of the surface. And if you ever see the actual pictures of the different landing sites, you can see the vehicles themselves. You can see the landers on the surface, all six of them. You can see the three rovers that are left behind. And all those pictures are being taken from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And not to be outdone, China plans at the end of this year to send their sample return mission. They plan on landing on the front side of the moon, and eventually they have the capability now, they believe, to pick up some soil, some regolith, and send it back to China. Okay, just on to a different topic, unless somebody has a question. Little noisy. Signal's going up and down tonight. But it seems to be holding. Another mission that's coming up in the early 2020s is going to be the Europa Clipper. And the reason I bring that up, Europa Clipper's antenna, I think it's an 8-foot diameter dish. One they're actually going to use is being tested in an experimental test range. They call it the ETR in Langley. In Virginia, and Jet Propulsion Laboratories is doing that work, and it's a nice looking dish antenna. I thought it would be more of a mesh, but it's got a solid look to it. Not sure why they're doing that, but the room that it's in is it looks like an anaconic room almost, where like we're testing for sound or something, but. Interesting, and they said they looked all over for this. And Dick, you would probably like the picture of this. I should get this over to you, because this is a test facility for testing antennas, and I think it's like 25 feet in diameter. It's not all that big, maybe a little bit bigger, but I know you worked in a place like that, so apparently this thing is like the cat's meow. They said they went all over the country and they liked this one the best. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've done some work at the anechoic chambers at AIL. AIL had two or three of them. I also did some work at the really big chamber out at Edwards Air Force Base, the Benningfield anechoic facility, which is roughly 300 feet squared and 7 stories high, internal dimensions. 1.5 acres of floor space of an anechoic chamber, where you put a whole B-1B bomber in there and on a turntable and rotate it and squirt signals at it and test out all of its electronic countermeasures hardware. So anechoic chambers are very scientific looking, fun to work at times. and they simultaneously give you a very quiet room, even though they're not intended for soundproofing, they're intended for radio proofing. But very few anechoic chambers have high performance below 1,000 megs. There's a reason for that, the laws of physics and the way you put the pyramid absorbers on the wall. They have to get very large when you go below 1,000 megs. So an awful lot of 1,000 meg and below testing is done on outdoor antenna ranges because it would be too expensive and too large a chamber to do it indoors. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. And the reason I really ask you about this is over all these decades, shouldn't they have the stance with science? You know, I need an 8-foot dish or I need a 7-foot dish, whatever it might be. They know the measurements. Don't they know beforehand that this is going to work? I mean, they're going to use X-band and Ka-band on this thing. But they've used antennas like this before. Can't they just, like, duplicate something that they had in the past? Why do they have to go through all this testing, for an X-band and Ka-band dish antenna, which they've done many, many times before? Is this because this is going to Europa and it's actually going to orbit Jupiter, and it's going to be 40 different orbits around Jupiter, and each time they go around Jupiter, they're going to go very close to Europa and take pictures and do whatever they have to do all their science, and then they're going to swing away from it. They can't put something into orbit around Europa because Europa is very close to Jupiter and it's right in the high radiation field. They say a space vehicle wouldn't last long if it was in orbit. So they're just going to go in, do a little science, pictures, whatever it is, and get away and then transmit that information back, and this is going to happen over and over again. Do you think that's the reason they're testing this thing, to see that this is going to hold up in a certain environment? Back to you, Dick.
Paul, for the most part, you never put an anechoic chamber, you never put a parabolic dish in an anechoic chamber to test it. Gain of a parabolic dish is purely a problem of geometry. If the surface is smooth enough, if the surface is reflective enough, and if the feed horn is properly designed, you don't have to test the dish. On top of that, a parabolic dish antenna frequently has a near-field range that's much, much bigger than the chamber. That 12-foot dish of mine had a near-field range of 700 feet at 2 gigahertz. You can't put a 700-foot antenna range addition. So if you're putting a dish in a chamber to do a test, then maybe it's one of these dishes that unfolds and you're finding out how smooth the surface is going to be when it unfolds. So you're doing a mechanical test, or you're doing a temperature, air pressure, and vacuum test. But the gain of the dish itself does not have to be confirmed in a chamber once you know the geometry of the dish. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW. You only build an anechoic chamber for a brand new antenna type that you've never tested before, and you want to see the three-dimensional pattern. As I said, you don't do that with a parabolic dish. WS2N, K2IW.
K2RY1.
Oh, okay. I got it. I'm going to, well, not tonight, but maybe tomorrow I'll send you the picture and the info. I heard Joe. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, listen to most of the tech net, but I couldn't transmit earlier on DHF because they're taking something off the air. Hopefully this way isn't bothering it, but it doesn't really just matter. My question was, Nick, you said this many times, that the noise floor that you have in different frequency bands on the Earth is very high on the low frequencies, and it slopes down 6 dB per octave as you go higher and higher frequency.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh, I got timed out. Would you experience the same thing on other planetary bodies like Mars and things like that? You think, do they have the same kind of noise floor or conditions, or is it just a different type of situation, because you don't have storms and other things producing electrical energy all over the spectrum?
There's many sources of noise there, Joe. Our atmosphere makes a whole lot of sources of noise, particularly our ionosphere, when you're down to the HF frequencies. Because Mars has so little atmosphere, I'm pretty sure it has almost no ionosphere. So while the noise that a receiver on the surface of Mars sees differently than Earth, absolutely. So of the sources of noise on the Earth, You've got a lot of atmospheric noise, you've got a lot of man-made noise, and you do have some space noise. Cosmic rays and whatever are also making noise. So Mars will have those. But all the components that were due to mankind and the atmosphere on Mars, I think almost none of that's going to be their show. Dimitri, KGIW.
Okay. And what kind of noise floor do you think the Voyager spacecraft physics is encountering as it's like 13 billion miles away? Do you think there's a noise floor that you'd have to deal with also? Or is it disappeared because it's so far away from any other, you know, celestial body?
If Voyager had a super-sensitive receiver with a low-noise preamplifier, it would be able to see some noise of space. However, for a bunch of reasons of reliability on that receiver, and because you've got a huge transmitter out at Goldstone, the 240-foot dish with a 10-kilowatt transmitter, to keep it simple, Voyager has a simple mixer front end. Does not have a state-of-the-art noise figure. Voyager does not see the noise that's around it. It's a receiver. The only noise it sees is the noise of its own receiver after that first mixer. So you could put a low-noise preamplifier on Voyager. That would make it more sensitive. That means you could use a little less uplink transmit power. But if that preamplifier fails, you've now got a dead receiver. So for reliability reasons, that receiver is a simple mixer front end. W2RYY, T2IW.
Better with the two channels. Actually, is this better on VHS? Yeah, it should be. Okay, I'll turn it this way. You just said something that's interesting. Just made me think about something. With Goldstone having that kind of power, 10 kilowatts on a microwave frequency, like 8.5 gig, and with the gain of the dish, that's a tremendous amount of ERP. Doesn't that start causing a real imbalance? Because you're going to get to a point where the spacecraft can hear you, and you can't hear the spacecraft anymore because it's, the uplink dialing is completely off balance.
Unbalance is perfectly all right. If you've got a 10 kilowatt transmitter and a 240 foot dish, it can send data at a megabit per second rate up on the uplink if you wanted to. The downlink, the way Voyager is designed, is that as it gets further and further and the signal gets weaker and weaker, you can only listen to that weaker and weaker signal on the ground with a more and more narrow bandwidth. So Voyager sends the data slower and slower as it gets further away, and they use a more and more narrow receiver, receiving less noise, and therefore it can receive a weaker signal, down to 150 hertz bandwidth at 8.5 gigs. Under normal conditions, you would never have enough frequency accuracy to do that, except Voyager is using the uplink signal as the reference for the downlink signal. Once you figure out the Doppler shift rates, you know the exact frequency it's coming down, because it's your signal being turned around and sent back to you, so to speak, as far as the carrier frequency is concerned. So unbalance is perfectly acceptable. That means your downlink data is a lot slower than your uplink data. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay, it's still interesting though, because you can only hear so far down the noise. Even if you shrunk your bandwidth down to like 10 or 15 hertz bandwidth, if it's capable of actually slowing down its data and going that tight on that frequency, you're still going to reach a point where you simply can't hear anything anymore, right? I mean, that's going to come someday, right?
Not necessarily. There's no limit as to how narrow you can make the receiver with modern-day electronics. Your data rate is going to get slower and slower, but you're sort of implying, could they go down to a 1 hertz bandwidth and receive 1 bit per second? The answer is absolutely yes. It's not comfortable, but it would work. It's not beyond the laws of physics. Over to you, Joe.
Okay. Yeah, very good. Very good. Yeah, I was just thinking about that before, because I was listening to the conversation earlier about the preamps. I don't know what frequency band the guy with the LNA, what he was trying to receive, but that has to have some sort of factor that comes into your equation. Even if you have a nice preamp that has a nice, light, nice low noise figure, if you have a high noise floor or higher than expected noise floor you're trying to listen through, what do you do? You can't hear something below the noise level.
Yeah, that's called a background limited system. I think Bill was building that preamplifier for 144 megs. And you do have, I don't know the exact number, but maybe the noise on the horizon at 144 megs is probably equivalent to something like a 6 dB noise figure, 4 dB noise figure, something in that neighborhood. When the antenna is aimed at the horizon, if you're doing the moon bounce and the signal is aimed at zenith, the noise power you see is a hell of a lot less. We ought to go back to Paul, because we're invading his time. WS2N, K2I, WGA, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. No, that's okay. In fact, I'm thinking that the guy that came up with this idea of sending the carrier wave up to the spacecraft and have that same wave, you know, coming back to him to make all these measurements and the guy that figured all that out, he should have got the Nobel Prize. That's what I was thinking about when you're talking about this. That's an amazing idea. I know. It came up with it decades and decades ago, of course. But wow. All right, let me drop. We'll go on to a different topic.
And that technique was used by the Deep Space Network, starting in either Mercury or Gemini. 240 over 221. In other words, the uplink frequency is divided to a lower frequency being sent down by the ratio of 240 over 221. As such, 2287.5 megahertz was the downlink frequency on Apollo 15 and many of the other Apollos. Uplink was 2106.4. So it's that ratio, 240 over 221. So you count every cycle going up, pseudo-random coded and whatever, and use that ratio as to generating the downlink frequency. So the downlink frequency is exact, using as a reference your uplink frequency. You don't have the problem of a crystal on board and an oscillator that ages and drifts and whatever. So it's very crafty. That was done in the early 60s for the Deep Space Network for at least Mercury and Apollo, and Gemini and Apollo, and probably for Mercury. And I've got the great big green book from NASA that they handed me when I visited Houston way back in...
Repeater, time out.
Way back in 1972, which explains the guy of how he invented that ball. And yes, I think he did get some awards. It's a really crafty system. WS2N, K2RAW.
I bet he did. Bobby said, I got an idea. We don't need a carrier frequency. Watch this. We'll have a remote carrier frequency. So, very good. There was a launch in India about a week and a half ago where they launched a total of 28 CubeSats, along with a couple of bigger satellites. But 28 CubeSats went up. And there's one for this and one for that. And most of them actually were for the United States. But different organizations and groups and schools, they make all these CubeSats. But the one interesting one I saw that was on the list was APRS amateur radio CubeSat. I don't know if it's working yet, but you have an APRS that was on board, and it was launched on the Polar satellite launch vehicle. Like I mentioned before, India has two rockets that they use, the Polar satellite launch vehicle. They tend to go into polar orbits, and then they have the geosynchronous launch vehicle for naturally putting their satellites into geosynchronous orbit, or for not only lunar, but interplanetary missions. India has their own spacecraft right now in orbit around Mars, and they're planning on another one. So they're out there pretty good. Between us and India and Russia, China, they're the main countries that are really leading the charge. And of course, all your private companies now. In fact, China has a private company that is starting to come along. They can't get into orbit yet, but they're trying real hard. But of course, we have SpaceX, and soon to be, in a couple of years, you're going to have Blue Origin launching the New Glenn spacecraft. So, sorry on that. Last week we were talking about how many hams are on board the space station. So it turns out there's 6 people right now on board the space station. And out of that 6, there's 3 people that are hams. We have Oleg Konienko, RN3DX from Russia. We have David St. Jacques from Canada, from the Canadian Space Agency, KG5FYI. You notice that it's an American call when they study and practice, and, you know, the astronauts there down in the Houston Space Center, the Johnson Space Center. And they all wind up with 5 calls because of that reason. That's where they get their tickets, as well as the third one, which is Nick Hague, KG5TMV. And KG5TMV almost didn't make it up there. Him and another Russian were on board the Soyuz spacecraft last April, and they were trying to make it up to the space station, and they wound up aborting as they actually got into space about 50, 60 miles up, and that's when their booster in the back, when it separated, it hit the core, and that was it. That's all she wrote. Right after that, the spacecraft aborted, and they wound up coming back to Kazakhstan in a parachute, safe and sound. And then Russia and the United States NASA decided to give them another shot. And that's why recently they sent those same 2 up, along with Christina Koch from the United States. She doesn't have a ham license. Kind of surprised at that. So you got 3 people with a ticket on board the space station. The 3 that were up there before that came down, they all had ham license. So, you know, I think we've had a ham in space continuously probably since the early 2000s.
But how many hams in space had Motorola make them a custom radio for use on their space voyage?
How many hams in space use Motorola? Right now they're using Kenwood. They have a ham radio set up in 2 locations, one in Columbia module, and then also in the Russian module, the Zvezda module. They actually have the antennas located in the functioning cargo block, Zarya, Joe. But something about Motorola, they were using Motorola at one time.
Owen Garriott in 1985, when he was on this space shuttle, was communicating with a handheld Motorola rig. When he talked to a bunch of hams on the Earth, I was one of them. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, they like Motorola. It's part of the SARex program, the Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment. That's what they called it when they were on board Shuttle. And then when the International Space Station got up there, they called it ARIS, A-R-I-S-S, Amateur Radio on board the International Space Station. And that's what we have today. And that's pretty much it. One other Mars story, I got time for this, is the HP3. That's the unit that was supposed to bang a hole into the surface of Mars and go down 15 feet. It's essentially a self-banging mole, and they thought it was going to work. They put it into an area that they thought that no rocks would be below them, and this mole, which is about 16 inches long, got, you know, 2/3 of the way out of the carrier, and it started going on an angle, and they think it hit a rock right away, and it's jammed. They're trying to find ways to get it back out again, but it doesn't have a reverse on it. It can't pound its way out, and they might try to use the arm, but right now it doesn't look good if they can.
they would just relocate it to a different location and try again. But from what I've been reading, most of the engineers think that they're not going to be able to be recovered, but they'll try for the next couple of months. So that's the story on that unit. The other unit that they put on the surface, the seismometer, they say is working very good. And that was the main one, was seismometer. But they did want to get this other heat probe temperature thing into the ground, 15 feet to the ground. It don't look like it's going to be happening, though. So, and that, and they have another, they have one of those radio test systems similar to what we just talked about, where they transmit up with a carrier and it goes directly to the vehicle and comes back to Earth. And they know exactly how far it is and where it is, where it's located, the angle that everything's sitting on. I mean, down to like, you know, a centimeter or something. They're using X-band. Any questions or comments? It's WS2X.
Paul, how far did the mole get before it hit the rock? And now it's been pounding away and not moving on that rock. Is it tilted off to one side to try to work its way around the rock? Are they fairly sure that it's not going to get any further? But how far did it get? And maybe it's not far enough to do that thermal experiment. Over to you, K2LAW.
Yeah, it only got, a foot down. They think that the top 4 inches is kind of still stuck in the carrying unit that was placed on the surface. So it didn't go far at all. It went on an angle right away. And then they said, well, it's designed to go on an angle. It could keep pounding. So they kept pounding, and it got even more jammed. Anytime you've done that, you're banging a chisel into something. And you know the experience. It goes in and it gets jammed. Well, we could pull it out, but they can't pull it out. There's no reverse on this. One other quick comment before I run out of time. The Starhopper by SpaceX down in Texas lit its engine for the first time. Right now it only has one engine on board. The idea is to fly this thing, this massive thing, about 30 feet in diameter. Looks like about 100 feet high. It would like to fly it and then eventually come down and land. Right now it's tethered to the ground. It was only went up a couple inches. Has one engine on board, 440,000 pounds of thrust. Well, you know, when they get it up to the highest thrust level, that's what it will be. And the ultimate goal is to put 31 of these things on the bottom of a heavy lift rocket. And eventually, this is Elon's goal of going to Mars. I just want to say that the Raptor, what they call it, the Raptor engine, attached to the Starhopper, which is going to be a test vehicle to see if they can fly it vertically and land it vertically. It's underway. Don't hold your breath. It's going to take a lot of years before this thing is ever ready to go to the moon or Mars. Any comments, questions? We're running out of time. This is WS2M. Dick, I'm looking at the time. I've run out of time. Back to you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Same to you, Roy. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you, you guys. That was segment 1742, Space Report 392. I got that right, 342. And Science Report number 71, or 74, one or the other. 73, you all. We'll be back 2 weeks from today. Bye-bye for now. K2LAW clear.
K2LAW, were you able to make use of the information I gave you in that email about a week or two ago?
I think so.
That's good. See you in 2 weeks. W2RY.
Bye-bye.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. WQVL repeater.
Newsline report number 2162 with a release date of Friday, April 5th, 2019. To follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Ham Radio pays tribute to radio officers around the world. Digital modes are in the spotlight. And a missing ham is found dead in Pennsylvania. All this and more as amateur radio...
Meet me over there,
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
82 QMS Mobile.
82 KNB.
Morning, Rich. How are you, TV?
Yes, sir.
Still good. Slept a little later today, but all right. Then I wonder if it's supposed to rain the rest of the day. It's funny because I ask Alexa first thing in the morning what the weather report is, and she, nothing about the rain.
Weather.com says it'll stop raining in the afternoon tomorrow around 70. It should be a nice afternoon.
Yeah, but the rain throws a damper on it. But whatever. Where are you heading off to this morning?
No pun intended, right? I don't know. I got to see if my doctor's in. I got to stop by there.
No pun intended. Okay. If your doctor's in, okay. All right. And then where?
I was talking about your comment on the weather. The office.
Okay. Because when you do your call out there, thought it was something else. And I guess, is this your only scene? So that you can stop at the doctor's office?
They may have to hang around there for a few minutes if he opens at 9.
Well, where is he, near the office or out here?
I don't know. About a mile from the repeater site.
Okay, so you'll wait around a little bit. All right. Still feeling better, though?
Yeah, but something got swollen last night. I'm trying to figure out what's going on with that. Nothing good.
Okay. Well, hopefully that'll turn out to be nothing. Anyway, I guess this is sounding pretty good, and the quality of the receive was this normal, you know, and the other thing wasn't normal.
Maybe it's got an actual problem, and the audio section is not working properly.
Talking about at the repeater site?
No, I'm talking about your other radio.
Oh, yeah, there's something that's wrong because I think I explained this, like, the onboard speaker is very tinny, so we go to an external speaker, but the radio is designed to use a stereo plug to have both the UHF and the VHF sides coming through the same speaker, and I think it's just, you know, not making the proper contact, so you hear one, but you don't hear the other, and this doesn't have the full range. This really has full range to it. Also, you know, I'm using the regular speaker, which is about a 4-inch speaker on this one.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing is they're using a 3-conductor plug to take the audio from two different receivers, and then they mix them into one speaker. That's usually not good for the audio amplifier section of either.
Yeah, good morning, Lou. Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know that part of it, but I don't know what else they could have done. I have the feeling it was the same in one of the ICOM D-Stars that I had. They only had one output. And, you know, in a car, it just wasn't sufficient enough. Lou, good morning. Go ahead and pick it up.
Yeah, good morning, guys. NY2H. I was just talking to Jeff. He may come over now soon. Also, we're on DMR. And, you know, we flipped him in the mornings now. And we just ran a test, and it worked very well. So, that we're doing double duties here until 9 a.m. As you, if you saw on the map, you'll read exactly what I'm talking about. He doesn't want me to talk about it too much. But there you go. And I guess Steve is bringing the unit in with him, so this should be an exciting morning. Steve, how you doing? Good morning.
N2ION.
There goes the neighborhood. sure if I make it in there. Oh, yeah, Rich, excuse me for 1 second. Did you